Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for supporting public broadcasting in your community. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. A concert by a top 40 pop singer near Fort Lauderdale. And a popular country band performing near Tampa. Are just two cases of the state of Florida looking into the possibility that they broke state law banning so-called vaccine passports. Concertgoers to Harry Styles and the Zac Brown Band had to show proof of vaccination or a negative COVID-19 test. Now, the audio is from social media posts from concertgoers. Dozens of companies, events, local governments are being investigated for their vaccine requirements. A public records request of the State Department of Public Health by the Orlando Sentinel found over 100 complaints are, quote, under review, according to the state. An airline, a cruise ship operator, a defense contractor, even a public library are on this list. Now, a state law bans companies from requiring customers to be vaccinated and prohibits local governments from requiring vaccinations. This is Governor Ron DeSantis last month.
If you're a government agency, you can't deny, you know, access to that. If you're denying access to somebody to show up for their job, to us, we think that that's something that applies, and the Attorney General has reviewed it, and she believes that as well.
This week, the state fined Leon County $3.5 million for its vaccine policy, calling it a, quote, blatant violation. Leon County calls its employee vaccination requirement legally justifiable, necessary, and responsible. So does your town or county have a vaccination requirement? What about a company that you do business with? What's allowed and what isn't? 305-995-1800. Statewide on this Friday here on the Florida Roundup, let's hear from you. 305-995-1800. Your thoughts on vaccine requirements, mandates, testing requirements. We're also on Twitter at Florida Roundup. Ken Cornell is with us. Ken is the chair of the Alachua County Board of County Commissioners. Chair Cornell, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So the Alachua Board of County Commissioners appears on this state list of entities under review for vaccination policies. What is the Alachua County government vaccination policy?
Sure. We have asked all of our employees whether or not they have been vaccinated or not. For those that have not, we are asking and requiring that they get tested weekly. That they wear masks inside, and that's our policy. We have also taken the policy of not hiring anyone that has not been vaccinated.
So let's dig into this a little bit here, Chair. You're asking employees about their status. Are you requiring employees to disclose their vaccination status as a condition of their jobs?
We are, yeah. We think it's important that we understand the risks for them as well as for those that are working with them. We have been following closely the results of folks that are being hospitalized, and there's overwhelming evidence that shows that if you are hospitalized, most of those are hospitalized for COVID that are not vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And as many folks know, we are self-insured. Taxpayers pay our health care. And there's a big cost for folks that are choosing not to get a free vaccine to protect themselves, their families, and the folks around them. And so if you are choosing not to get vaccinated, then you will be getting tested weekly if you want to work for Alachua County.
So have you fired any employees for not being vaccinated, for not showing proof of vaccination?
We have not. No, we've actually had really, really good compliance in Alachua County with regards to the reporting. A high 70% of folks at Alachua County have been vaccinated. Those that haven't are getting tested mm-hmm. weekly. We've only had a handful of folks that actually didn't even want to get tested. However, what I will say about that is that policy has really helped keep our county employees safe. We've identified five or six folks that had COVID, didn't know it, and they were quarantined. And as a result of that testing, there was no spread.
Chairman, you mentioned that you're requiring employees to disclose their vaccination status as a condition of their employment. Have employees failed to disclose their vaccination status?
No, we've had 100% compliance.
100% compliance. And so someone can 100%. Say they're not vaccinated, and that then kicks in the other part of the vaccination policy for Alachua County. Is that correct? Which exactly. is the testing requirement.
That's exactly right.
I see.
Exactly.
And has anybody refused to be tested who's not vaccinated?
I think we've had a handful of folks that have resisted, but I'm not aware of anyone having to be terminated because okay. they weren't following the policy.
So, as you know, Chair, Alachua County, the Board of County Commissioners, the group that you're the chairman of, appears on this state list from the Department of Health regarding entities that are being investigated for potentially violating Florida state law. Do you believe that the Alachua County vaccination policy violates the so-called vaccine passport law in the state of Florida?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I have absolutely no concerns or worries at all that we've done anything illegal. In fact, you know, when I think about it, I think we've really been a model for what a county should be doing. We haven't been contacted by DOH. We're not on, you know, we weren't aware that we were even on a list when we found out. We looked at the list, and I'll tell you, it seems to be a pretty good list of folks that seem to be doing a lot of the right things. So, no, I have no concerns about being on a list.
So state law reads, the state law that the governor is citing and others are leaning against, which was passed in this most recent legislative session, reads that it prohibits governmental entities from requiring persons to provide documentation certifying vaccination against or recovery from COVID-19. Is Alachua County requiring documentation certifying vaccination?
Well, we asked folks if you had been vaccinated or not, and if they have not, then we're asking that they get tested. So,
but you're doing more than asking, right? You're requiring some kind of proof of vaccination. If you're asking and someone says yes, do you just leave it at that?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure okay. what our HR department does to verify that what they're telling us is the truth. So I'm not sure about that.
Understood, Chair. Yeah. As you know, Leon County was fined a little over $3.5 million this week as the state contends that it is violating this state law, opening up to this $5,000 per infringement fine that's included in the state statute. Is Alachua County prepared to pay any fine that the state may levy against it?
No, we're not expecting, nor are we going to pay any fines that the state levies. If we receive a bill, we'll just send it back.
You send it back unpaid?
Correct.
Okay, fair enough. Chair, I appreciate your transparency there.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and again, you know, our policies are driven by our local experts and scientists. We're following guidance from the University of Florida, from UF Health. They are some of the best in the country and in the world. And so we think it's the right thing to do for not only our employees, for the people they work with. You know, many folks that are vaccinated that are working, they want to make sure that it's a safe environment, and ultimately for the taxpayers who have to pay our salaries and our healthcare costs.
Ken Cornell is the chairman of the Alachua County Board of County Commissioners. Chairman, thanks for your time today on the Florida Rundown. Much appreciated.
Appreciate you including us. Have a great day.
Of course. We're talking about vaccine passports, vaccine requirements, mandates in the state of Florida, as the state is investigating over 100 different entities in the state that it contends it has received complaints against vaccine requirements. 305-995-1800 across the state of Florida here. Line 3, Roy in Rockledge. You're up. Go ahead, Roy. You're on the radio. Thanks for calling.
One moment, please. Still there?
Yes, we're still here. Go ahead, Roy.
I work in a terminal in a location I don't think I should mention that deals with passengers.
Okay.
And it is required when people go through this safety, you know, like the magnetic detectors for weapons and things, their mm-hmm. second stop, is they are to show a vaccination certificate and a recent COVID test. And this is what airlines have been requiring. Everybody in that terminal, passengers and staff for the company, wear masks. That includes me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just a fair deal. Mm. I don't like masks, but But I'm perfectly okay with, if everybody's doing it, I'm going to do it.
Roy, let me ask you, are you, pardon the interruption there, Roy, are you required to show proof of vaccination or proof of a negative test to go to work?
I never was. When I've got this job recently, and when I went to apply for it, I had my vaccine card, and I said that I would show it because I think it was my right to have a vaccine. I'm joking with him, but still, I did show them that, and I offered to show it, and the person who was interviewing me said, "No, I don't need to see that. I'll take your word for it."
Hmm.
But when I on the job, I have to wear a mask.
Right.
And like I said, I hate masks. But it's necessary to do it there. We're all protected. Everyone else is wearing a mask. And so I do that.
We got you.
It's just that simple.
Roy, thanks for that that input there. Roy is working at a cruise ship terminal. Roy and Rockledge there joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Wayne Messam is with us. Wayne is the mayor of the city of Miramar in Broward County. Mayor Messam, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Your city also appears on this Department of Health list of entities investigated for possibly violating the state ban on vaccine requirements. What is the city policy in Miramar?
Well, in the city of Miramar, in response to significant uptick in positive COVID-19 cases with our employees and unfortunately actually losing a couple of our valued city employees, we basically felt it was necessitated to for immediate action to protect our workforce as well as the public that we serve. So we have asked that our employees be on November 1st, that we will start our weekly testing for COVID-19. So we are incentivizing our employees to be vaccinated. For those who are not vaccinated, they would be required to have weekly COVID-19 tests.
Asking City Hall and police officers to be vaccinated, are you requiring it?
Well, our weekly testing begins November 1st. We're not penalizing our employees for not being vaccinated. But if they don't want to have the weekly testing to ensure that our workplace is safe and that our city facilities that is open to the public are safe, they would have to show proof that they've been fully vaccinated to not have to have the weekly test. Now, we are incentivizing our employees by giving them $500 if they're vaccinated by November 1st. But if they choose not to show that they've been vaccinated or if they aren't vaccinated, then they'll just have to have a weekly test beginning November 1st.
Now, the state law that was passed by this legislature, that so-called vaccine passport law, does allow local governments from, quote, instituting screening protocols consistent with guidance to protect public health. Presumably that would include testing for COVID-19. The governor contends that requiring as a condition of employment a COVID vaccine is illegal. Is the city of Miramar requiring its City Hall employees and police officers to be vaccinated?
No, we're not. And that's why we think that the city of Miramar being on this list or even being investigated is not only ludicrous, but is definitely a breach and an overreach regarding our home rule authority to ensure that our public workforce and our workplace, as well as our public spaces, are safe for not only our valued city employees, but for the public. We feel that and we stand by our position in terms of making ensuring that our facilities are safe. So we were really surprised to see that we were listed on this.
Mayor Messam, thank you for sharing your perspective there from City Hall in Miramar and Broward County. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Wayne Messam there, the mayor of Miramar. John Kennedy, I want to bring you into the conversation now. John's a reporter for the Capital Bureau of USA Today Network here in Florida. John, welcome back to the program, by the way. What's the state's strategy here? What's going on with this list of 120 different entities, including a number of local governments like Alachua County and the city of Miramar?
Well, I think it's a political shot from the governor's office. It's something designed, I think, largely to scare communities, governments, these private business entities, theaters, convention centers, everybody that's on the list, into basically dropping whatever kind of vaccine requirement that they may have, whether it be, you know, for patrons, customers, mm-hmm. or for employees. It's the governor's way of getting out in front of the Biden administration, which is still to still has not yet released that rule that it said it would, that would require companies with 100 or more employees to have them show proof of vaccination or, you know, undergo COVID testing. So I think there's a lot of politics at play right now where it's kind of a warning shot across the bow of these entities.
We have one tweet from a listener saying, "Go Alachua County, stand up for my right to be in public spaces and be safe as possible." You can add your voice to the social media thread there at Florida Roundup. John, this this push to ban vaccine passports, which really is not a thing in the United States, but rather a vaccine requirement, it began because of a cruise ship operator, Norwegian, requiring passengers and crews to be vaccinated. The company has fought against that new law and has been steadfast in requiring passengers who are boarding its ship to show proof of vaccination. And the governor has continued to fight that in appeals court.
That's right. And that is still in federal court,
yeah.
And still unresolved. Meanwhile, you do have, you know, Disney World is requiring its employees to be vaccinated. So it's somewhat ironic that the governor, in many respects, Republican governor, is going up against a lot of large businesses that are pretty much a reliable ally,
yeah,
to the Republican Party in this state.
Yeah. And you know, as I think through this, John, and have been following your coverage and the coverage of others, that original executive order back in the month of May, which led to the vaccine, the so-called vaccine passport law, was really directed at, my understanding was, companies requiring customers, like Norwegian Cruise Lines, customers to be vaccinated, as opposed to companies requiring employees to be vaccinated or require regular testing.
That's right. It's become blurred, I think, deliberately by the governor over the last few months. And now he is sort of extending this law to include the idea that, you know, you could require an employee to show proof.
Yeah. John Kennedy, reporter for the Capitol Bureau, USA Today Network in Florida. John, great to have you back. Thanks for sharing your reporting.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's talk to John in Tampa real quick. John, I got about 1 minute, but we wanted to hear from you. Go ahead. John, are you with us on the radio?
Hello?
Hello, John. I've got about 45 seconds. Please go. We'd love to hear from you.
I just want to run a travel agency, and I just want to say that the vaccine, I just got back from Europe. It's enabled us back to normal. And Florida is a tourism state, and people, when Franco Rio sued him, it was to address the passenger safe and the crew safe.
Yeah.
So this is about safety. It's not about politics.
John, welcome back to the state of Florida. Welcome back to the USA. Glad to have you back.
Yeah. Well, we stopped at Wawa after France, and it was kind of shocking. But
culinary or public health-wise? All right, we'll leave that out there, John.
Public health-wise, no, okay. And my mother's going back to Larry Gregory. Thanks.
All right, John in Tampa there joining our conversation here, talking about vaccine passports, vaccine employment requirements here in the state of Florida. Coming up next, we're going to talk about breast cancer. The first lady in the state of Florida has been diagnosed with breast cancer. We're going to talk about the issue of this disease and fighting this cancer here in the state of Florida. Next, please share your experiences if you or a family member have had to battle this disease. 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800 as the Florida Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. More than 20,000 Floridians will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year, according to estimates from the American Cancer Society. Thousands of families are living with the disease. Thousands more are survivors. Florida's first family finds itself as one of the most recent families dealing with a breast cancer diagnosis. Last week, the governor's office announced First Lady Casey DeSantis had breast cancer. The governor made his first public comments this week.
She is a very, very strong woman. It's not an easy thing when this happens, because it's just, you know, your life is going. Then all of a sudden, this is something that puts that in the balance.
The type and stage of Casey DeSantis's breast cancer has not been released. According to 2018 data from the Centers for Disease Control, the rate of new breast cancer diagnoses in Florida is slightly below that of the national rate. So let's talk about breast cancer here in the Sunshine State. Have you or a loved one fought this disease? What resources did you find helpful? What resources would you have liked? What resources perhaps are you using now if you or a loved one is currently in a battle with breast cancer? And are there practices or policies that can help fight and find breast cancer here in Florida? 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800. You can also share your thoughts on Twitter. We are at Florida Roundup. Dr. Saronya Chumsri is an associate professor of medicine at the Mayo Clinic Cancer Center in Jacksonville. Doctor, welcome to the program. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
How big of an issue is breast cancer here in Florida?
Yeah, so as you know, breast cancer is a very common disease. So one out of eight women will develop breast cancer in their lifetime. If you look at the previous publication from Department of Florida, breast cancer in Florida actually ranked as number two in the country for the incidence of new breast cancer. This is probably because, you know, breast cancer is a disease of aging, and, you know, over 18% of our patient populations are actually older than age 65.
Does it also speak to intervention and preventative or regular checkups in Florida that may be perhaps more common here in this state compared to other locations?
That may be the case, because if you look at the data with the, you know, the amount of the screening, so the more screening we do, then we potentially will diagnose more breast cancer. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, the thing is that if we detect it earlier, breast cancer can be highly curable disease if you detect it early, compared to, you know, once it's more advanced, it's much more difficult to treat, and sometimes it can recur. If you look at the data back in 1970s, you know, when we started mammogram, there were more cases, but then it's not always the case. Mm-hmm. Because even now, having the screening mammograms been around for quite some time now, the incidence of breast cancer is still kind of creeping up gradually over the past few years.
Dr. Chumsri, we often hear about a disparity in access to screening among different races in Florida and across the nation. What groups are most impacted by this disparity and why?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at, there are several data now that showing that minorities like African American or Hispanic or even American Indian, the rate of completion of the screening mammogram, it's lower in those population. The concerning part is that if you look at the publication from American Cancer Society, state of Florida is actually one of the six states in the country that the mortality rate of breast cancer actually surpassing the lung cancer mortality among African-American patients. So as you know, breast cancer, again, is highly curable disease if detected at the earlier stage. On the other hand, if you find out later on, then the mortality rate go up.
Yeah.
Compared to lung cancer, you know, lung cancer normally is the number one leading cause mm-hmm. of cancer death. But in minorities here, at least in Florida, unfortunately, the mortality rate of breast cancer is actually number one.
Yeah, so the fatality rate of breast cancer among Black Floridians is higher,
right.
Yeah. than that of the
yes.
death rate from lung cancer.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. And this is probably many things that reflect that, you know, first of all, it might be related to the screening, and also the access to care. So all of those things probably play a role into that, you know, mortality. incidence. Yeah.
Dr. Saronya Chumsri is with the Mayo Clinic Cancer Center in Jacksonville. Doctor, stick with us. We want to say hello to Katie in Orlando on line three. Katie, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling today. You're on the radio.
Thank you. Hi. I want to call in because I'm excited to say that I'm a cancer survivor twice. I just had a double mastectomy this July 15th from the best breast cancer surgeon, Dr. Danielle Chambers, and I'm so happy with my recovery and just now being cancer-free because my mother passed away of breast cancer 27 years ago. One of my sisters got breast cancer, and I just knew that once it came back, I was not going to play with it. Just take the girls off, be have peace of mind, and I am free at last, and I feel so, I hope I can say damn good.
You can absolutely say damn good, Katie, after all that. Congratulations. I'm so happy that you can share that great news with us, and thank you for listening, and good health to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Much appreciated. Yeah. Let's say hello to Cynthia Farah. Cynthia is a breast cancer survivor herself and the lead national volunteer for Making Strides Against Breast Cancer. Cynthia, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. What do you think there from Katie in Orlando when you hear that kind of story?
It's amazing. You know, you could hear the excitement in her voice. What Dr. Chumsri said was true. We do have a lot of breast cancer in Florida, but what's important is that we take the reins, if you will, we advocate for ourselves, and we make sure that we are doing everything we can to live a long, healthy life. And it sounds like Katie is doing that.
Yeah, indeed. Great for her and her family. Cynthia, what questions and what issues do people and their families with a new breast cancer diagnosis, like the first family, like the DeSantis's, what do they face in these first few weeks of that diagnosis?
Well, it really is a whirlwind. I worked in breast health and cancer services for many years in Jacksonville, and we would always tell our patients the very first thing that's going to happen is that you're going to meet five or six physician specialists, from your surgeon to your radiation oncologist to your chemotherapy doctor to your plastic surgeon, possibly. So there's a lot of information coming at you all at once. And it's really, with all the emotional turmoil you're going through, it's really too much for one person. So we always, always, always tell people to have that advocate that's standing next to you. Now, in many big cancer centers, we have nurse navigators, and those are people that can go with you to appointments, help schedule appointments, and make sure that if there's any bumps in the road, that they're taking care of those for you. But what I always tell patients is to bring a spouse, bring a best friend, bring a relative, whoever you feel comfortable with, someone who can take notes, because you're going to listen to somebody one day. The next day, you might have gotten 5% of what they said.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
not going to know what kind of surgery they recommended. You're not going to remember the types of chemotherapy that are out there for you. So if somebody has those notes and someone who's more clear-headed at the time, that's the first thing I would say, is make sure you know who that person is.
Dr. Chumsri talked about access and the difference and the disparities in access, particularly racial disparities, and how that affects mortality among blacks in Florida for breast cancer, for instance. Cynthia, you caught your cancer early. What can you share with us about your experience in accessing healthcare, some of the challenges, the pinch points, and how you were able to address them?
Well, I'm a little bit different because I did work in the breast center. Mm-hmm. So every day of every year, part of my job is to make sure that my staff and myself spoke to patients on the front end, whether it would be a health fair or a church gathering or through our mobile mammography unit. And we would stress education. And through that, we would talk about access. And so what we see is in the Hispanic and African American communities that there are definite points of access where they have trouble. You know, not everybody has a car. When you take some of the big cities we have, Tampa, Jacksonville, Miami, you know, you can't really walk to every place you need to go to. You really need a car. And to put someone on chemotherapy and say, okay, you need to take three buses to get home, that's really not going to work. So it's a definite problem. As a volunteer for the American Cancer Society, we are working on access issues. We see those disparities, and we know they're real. They're not something that someone just said, oh, it's hard to get to cancer care. It's real, and what we know is that a lot of times people go without care.
Right.
They don't get their screenings, they don't get their treatment, and that's why you see the mortality rate go up.
Yeah, there are real disparities with real consequences in these individuals' lives and their households and their families. Doctor, let me ask you about access. You spoke about it a little bit earlier in the disparity. Just even the economics of it, the diagnostic tests, biopsies, other types of specialties to really hone in, if someone has a diagnosis, to really discover, obviously, the kind, the specific type of cancer, the stage, and of course the to develop a course of treatment. All of that can be very expensive, even with the best of insurance plans.
That is absolutely right, because, you know, breast cancer, it's a very highly curable disease, but on the other hand, we need all of these specialties, like what Cynthia was alluded for. Like most patients would need surgery, and then, you know, chemotherapy, even in some patient, radiation, all of those treatment does have very high costs, and having insurance is very important. And yes.
We are talking about breast cancer here in the state of Florida. Last week, Casey DeSantis, the wife of Governor Ron DeSantis, disclosed that she has been diagnosed with breast cancer. The governor made his first public comments regarding that diagnosis this week. If you'd like to share your experience, family experience with us, what questions do you have about breast cancer detection and intervention? 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. You can also share your experiences. We are on social media on Twitter. Our handle there is at Florida Roundup. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. In Punta Verde, we've got Jules on line three. Jules, thanks for calling. You are on the radio.
Thank you. Dr. Chumstree is my doctor at Mayo Clinic, and she's taking excellent care of me. I guess what I'd like to say to anyone, you know, who is facing a breast cancer diagnosis, who gets that bad news, it's so scary, because I think there's not enough education about how good the prognosis really is for most early stage breast cancer patients. I was stage one, and one of the first things my doctors told me was, you know what, we're going to fix you up. You have a 99% chance of being perfectly fine and living a long, normal, healthy life. So maybe Dr. Chumstree can, you know, kind of repeat that, because I think she's one of the people who told me that early on.
And Jules, you probably can't hear that enough, can you?
Exactly. And so please know, if you're scared to go in and get a mammogram, if you're scared to, you know, do your self-exams because you might find something,
right,
please don't let that stop you from getting checked. Go get checked, go get tested, and if you catch it early, you're going to be fine. I mean, it stinks. Cancer treatment is rough.
Yeah.
But I made it through, and you can too.
Jules, glad to hear it. Great for you to share that story here, and we really appreciate you calling in. As we know, breast cancer is not isolated to women. Men can experience breast cancer as well. Patrick is listening in Miami. Patrick, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Yeah, I am a 13-year survivor. I was diagnosed with stage 4. I went through all the chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But from day one, I kept a very strong mind. I told myself I will beat it, and I am still here 13 years later.
Oh, so that's wonderful.
Don't be afraid. I am stage 4 on top of that.
Wow.
So the most important thing to do is to, if you see something abnormal, run to your physician. Don't be shy and get the test. And from there, keep a very positive mind. Everything starts in your head.
Yeah.
If you keep a positive mind, you will go through that. It's not a big deal. And you will be fine.
Patrick, we appreciate you sharing that story. A male breast cancer survivor, Patrick, in Miami. Dr. Chumsri, what is the type of diagnosis that men should be aware of, in addition to what women should be aware of in terms of early intervention and getting those checkups?
Right. So breast cancer, as you mentioned, it's not disease of just female. So if you look at the incidence, about 2,000, over 2,600 cases of male breast cancer are diagnosing each year. I think there's less awareness for breast cancer in males. So most of the time, unfortunately, if you look at, staging for male breast cancer, unfortunately, it is usually diagnosed at the later stage. Most patients normally present, like by stage 3 or 4, like in Patrick's case. So the cure rate go down with each stage. So and the other thing is that we do not do the screening in male, patients. So it is very important for, the awareness. If you feel anything abnormal in the breast, like Patrick was mentioning, then make sure that you discuss that with your, physician and get that checked out. That's very important. Yeah.
Dr. Saronya Chumsri, Associate Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic Cancer Center in Jacksonville. Doctor, thanks for sharing your expertise with us. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank
Cynthia
you.
Farah is a breast cancer survivor, lead national volunteer for Making Strides Against Breast Cancer. Cynthia, thank you for sharing part of your afternoon with us today as well.
Thanks so much.
Still to come, we're going to talk about one of Florida's favorite marine mammals. It is Under Pressure. It's next. We're back here on the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for supporting public media in your community. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. Florida's beloved manatees are in trouble, real trouble. State wildlife officials reported nearly 1,000 of the marine mammals have died so far this year. It's a record-setting number of deaths, and it has conservationists and others sounding the alarm. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has asked state lawmakers for almost $7 million to help restore waterways that manatees call home across the state. Here's FWC's Gil McRae.
We have several projects in the hopper that we are ready to implement. We know this is something that's going to be critically important, so that is a budget request.
McRae says cleaning up manatee habitats is key to preventing more deaths. The mammal's key food source, seagrass, has been declining due to poor water quality. The decline is believed to be linked to many manatees dying of starvation this year. We want to hear from you. Are you concerned about Florida's manatees, water quality issues? What can be done to help the state waterways and these marine mammals that rely on them? 305-995-1800. Perhaps you've been out on a boat, on a vessel, on some waterways. Have you seen manatees lately? Perhaps you haven't seen them in locations where you normally would see the mammals. 305-995-1800 or at Florida Roundup on Twitter. Environmental reporter Amy Green is with our sister station in Orlando, WMFE. Amy, welcome back to the program. Nice to have you again.
Nice to be here.
Boy, this is a real sobering year and some real hard facts to digest when it comes to the state of these mammals in waterways across Florida. Record number of deaths. And are they still continuing?
That's right, Tom. Absolutely. It's an unprecedented crisis situation for Florida manatees. A record 968 manatees have died in Florida since January, and that number is more than double the five-year annual average, and it represents more than 10% of the animal's population in the state, which is estimated at more than 8,000. But the die-off is the latest in Florida. It's the latest in a series of die-offs in Florida. The previous record was 830 deaths in 2013.
And starvation has been identified as a significant cause. Is it the only? Is that what's fueling this unprecedented increase we're seeing this year, or are there other factors at play?
Yes, that's right. Manatees face many threats like red tide in Southwest Florida and boat strikes, but the primary culprit behind this year's die-off is a widespread loss of seagrass in the Indian River Lagoon. The Indian River Lagoon is one of the most important habitats in the world for manatees. And what we've seen this year in the Indian River Lagoon is it's a result of a series of cold snaps in the Indian River Lagoon back in December. Mm-hmm. And manatees are stressed in cold water. And so in an environment like the Indian River Lagoon, where there's been a widespread loss of seagrass, a sudden cold snap, leaves a manatee with a crucial choice, whether to stay where they are and potentially starve, or forage elsewhere and freeze. And so in the Indian River Lagoon this year, we saw just unfortunately a widespread, die-off on Florida's East Coast.
Yeah. Let's move from the East Coast over to the West Coast and bring in David Tomasco. He is with the Sarasota Estuary Group. He's the Chief Executive Officer. David, welcome to the program. Describe what you would normally expect to see in the Sarasota Estuary in terms of these marine mammals.
Well, we see manatee die-offs in Florida as sort of like a canary in the coal mine. Manatees need about 100, 200 pounds of seagrass a day to live. And, the biggest problem in the Indian River Lagoon is their seagrass meadows decline by about 60%, but the remaining 40% is so sparse that their overall food supply dropped about 90, 95%. So, yeah, they starve to death. And one of the ways that they die when they starve to death is they drown. Mm. And another thing they do when they start to starve to death is they beach themselves to prevent drowning and make themselves more susceptible to cold stress. So the problems we're seeing in the Indian River Lagoon manatee die-off is associated with the seagrass loss, which is associated with problems we've had with water quality. And we have water quality issues all throughout the state of Florida that are not really good right now.
Diagnose it, David, for your estuary in Sarasota, the contributors to it and what the short-term solution would be to, I suppose, stop this unprecedented die-off in manatees that Florida is experiencing.
Well, I think our community has really shown it's serious. We had a big workshop last week, and our local governments are going to, they have on the books, they have planned capital improvement projects for the next 5 to 10 years. Close to $1 billion to deal with wastewater and stormwater issues that we have. Our seagrass coverage peaked in about 2016, and we're 22% below that. So we're not as bad as the Indian River Lagoon, but we don't want to get as bad as the Indian River Lagoon. And the reality is, if you want to halt the manatee die-off, you have to halt the decline of seagrasses. And if you want that to happen, you have to talk serious dollars for fixing our water quality problems. We've got a rapidly growing population. Our stormwater and wastewater infrastructure has not been up to the task for accommodating the growth that we've had the last couple of decades. And so our local community is looking to, invest seriously in the types of work that needs to be done to bring about the re-restoration of Sarasota Bay.
We are talking about this unprecedented increase up to record number of manatee deaths so far this year, already this year here in the state of Florida. 305-995-1800, maybe you're regularly on Florida waterways. What normally have you experienced in terms of manatees? What have you seen over the last few months? 305-995-1800 as you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Ryan sent us this tweet. Is there any correlation between the amount of water being pumped out of the aquifer by bottled water companies in regards to water quality issues? This would be mostly on the west coast of Florida. David, I'm going to put that to you as you're talking to us from the Sarasota area.
We don't really, that's not an issue that we have in the Sarasota Bay and Tampa Bay areas. I'm not sure if that's a problem somewhere else. Our major issues are wastewater, stormwater, the fact that 50% of our watershed is urbanized and over application of fertilizer. Some of these things are, you know, frankly, they can be addressed through public education. We have people that are irrigating and fertilizing their lawns in excess and creating a nutrient problem. So it's not just their lawn that's looking green, it's their bay.
Amy, and, what about, pardon the interruption there, David, let me bring Amy Green in, environmental reporter from WMFE, back into the conversation here, David. Amy, what about that estuary in the Indian River Lagoon area, which has been the site of so many of these manatee deaths this year?
Right. Well, just to go back a second to the caller's question about the pumping by the bottling companies, mm-hmm. and that has been an issue in North Florida and Florida's, you know, very treasured springs. And springs, of course, are an important manatee habitat. And so what happens as a result of pumping like that is it affects the flow of the springs, and it just, you know, takes water away from the springs, and there's just not as much water to flow through those springs, and that affects the manatee habitat that way.
Let's hear from William in Palm Bay. William, you are on the radio. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment about manatees that here in Palm Bay, also off of the Indian River Lagoon, manatees represent a very unique gem in the crown of Florida. Other areas of the world, other ecosystems have apex predators. Manatees are an apex herbivore. Mm-hmm. They have a unique niche where they don't have the same challenges that other apex predators face. And this manatee die-off is extreme in our concern for it. We should be very concerned with this. I love to take my kids off in the woods. We go walking on the little sanctuary nature trails, and we get to see them.
Yep.
Here.
Yep.
Turkey Creek is a wonderful example of that. And when we can't experience that, the wonderful, I guess, the experience of seeing manatees, everyone loves it.
Yeah.
This is something that concerns all of Florida.
Yeah, indeed, William. As much as us Floridians like to look and stare and point to alligators, boy, you spot a manatee in the water, Amy, and you're going to get a crowd around it right away with a lot of smiles. What are some of the state efforts initially that are being considered, I guess, in the short term?
Well, sure. This calamity has prompted an urgent federal state effort to brace for potentially more deaths this winter because the water quality problems and seagrass losses in the Indian River Lagoon are not going to be resolved anytime soon. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has designated the die-off this year as an unusual mortality event, and that prompts a federal investigation into what's happening with the manatees and how to prevent further deaths. And also, the Florida legislature included $8 million for manatees in the state budget this spring, and that funding is for habitat restoration and for springs. And you know, others who I've talked to, people who are involved in manatee rescue in the Indian River Lagoon, have talked to me about how, you know, they're holding regular meetings to, you know, plan for another potential die-off this winter, and they're meeting about how to maximize resources and work together in the event that happens. I also visited a rehabilitation center at SeaWorld here in Orlando, mm-hmm. where they are bracing for another die-off by moving healthier animals to other facilities to free up the medical pools there at SeaWorld for more fragile animals.
So disheartening to hear about the preparations for this to continue, but important preparations to help try to save those manatees that we can save. Amy Green, environmental reporter at WMFE, our sister station in Orlando. David Tomasco is the executive director of the Sarasota Bay Estuary Program. David and Amy, thank you for sharing your time today.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville, WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Perdomo are the producers. Catherine Hobbs, the associate producer, the director of radio operations in Miami, and our technical director is Peter Merritt. Engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for calling, tweeting, listening, and supporting public broadcasting. For my co-host Melissa Ross, I'm Tom Hudson.
UF Health North, a comprehensive medical campus, including 24-hour